Session number 14806.
Mr. Eddie Murray, side form. Were you? How much contact were you keeping with your family then?
Oh, I was writing. Mm. You know, I'm sure. Once a fortnight, anyhow.
What do you think your brother made of you, having not actually?
Well, apparently, I was really in the. I was really in the in the mud.
Yeah.
Because, and he's got it all wrong. He said that I left on a Saturday, and I know for a fact I didn't leave on a Saturday. But he said he was due. He was only off on a Saturday because he was due to leave on the Sunday for a football match in Belgium. But because I'd gone, they'd phoned him up. They'd phoned him up to tell him to come in because I wasn't there. Mm. So that must have been on the Monday, do you see? But we got our wires tangled. But we're the best of friends now. Mm. But I think
so he's put out.
He sort of resented it because it was something that, I mean, he was in the fire service during the whole of the war, which was pretty exciting. He married an Irish girl and he had several children, and his wife's dead and he's still living in Acton. He's about 84, 85 now. But I'm sure that he always resented that episode of my life and our lives.
And what did your parents make of it then?
They were terribly worried, very worried. In fact, I went to Alderman Wood School, and they mentioned me in, you know, this grammar school business. Mm-hmm. And I was, as I said, a pretty good pupil, very good pupil. And I was particularly good at art.
Yes.
And I've taken up oil painting again over the past couple of weeks or so. taking up oil painting, which was one of the things,
yes,
of course, that Churchill did.
Yes.
And when we first met up, Churchill and I, later on, you know, he recognized the fact. But, so I was pretty good at art, and we did a fresco, three of us did a fresco all around the art room at the grammar school of Croydon Airport, which we'd never seen, mm-hmm. but we did it from, aeroplanes and that sort of thing were exciting, let's face
sure.
it, especially in those days. And so I suppose there was a bit of a connection there. But I was pretty good at moulding, and I did a deer. Was it a deer or an ibis? Probably ibex. Mm. Ibex. With great big long curving horns, do you see? And it was in a crouching position, and its head was slightly turned to the right. And so one of the horns was just touching the top of its back,
yeah.
and the other one was sort of inside its side, you know, just pushing into its side. And it was very good, and it apparently won quite a number of exhibitions afterwards. But I didn't know, because the last I saw of it was in the glass case in the art room. And my mother, you know, heard about it and knew about it as it was, you know, winning exhibitions. And then suddenly it was Dr. Carr, who himself, I think, had a bit of a business. He was friendly, I think, to the Germans during the war. In what he's, you know, in his speech, speeches that he made.
Who
and
was
I know
this?
He was investigated by the police. He was the headmaster at the time.
Oh, I see, of your school,
He'd taken over from
right.
Dr. Hardy, and it was Dr. Carr.
Right.
And
so you were saying your mother was very worried about this.
And so there was a certain time during my life at Cider, I had an uncle, Uncle Tom, who went down at the first battle of the Falkland Islands.
Oh, yes, in the Great War.
What, Calomel or something like that, it was called, and he went down on the Good Hope. And at exactly the moment that he was going down, and the ship was sunk, apparently, on the paternal side, my paternal grandmother was asleep, and she woke up in the middle of the night, certain that Uncle Tom was talking to her. Really? And it was only afterwards, you see, that they discovered that it was exactly at that moment that the ship was going down.
Yes, yes.
She found out at a much later date.
Yes.
And here am I inside, in the French Foreign Legion.
Yes.
You know, and one day, apparently, my mother had a similar dream.
About you?
About me.
Oh, dear.
And that I was dead.
Oh.
And she was quite certain, but you know, that something had happened to me. And so she got in touch with Dr. Carr, wrote a letter to him, and asked, because she was quite sure that something had happened to me, could she have, as a souvenir, as a souvenir,
yes,
the model that was in the glass case in the art room.
Right.
And for years and years she had the letter, apparently, but it's disappeared somewhere. Maybe my brother's got it.
Mm.
That a letter from Dr. Carr saying that he regretted very much indeed, you know, that she thought that her son, Edmund, had something happen to him. But as far as the model was concerned, until she could produce, because it was such a renowned model, if you like, or, you know, a great thing for the school to have this model in their glass case as an exhibit, until such time as she could produce proof that I was dead, the thing would be remaining there. And so as soon as I got back in 46, you know, early in 47, I made another model.
All right.
And it's my brother who's got it now.
Oh, okay.
Because I cast it in plaster of Paris, of course, and but eventually it finished in lead.
Sorry.
And so it's, you know, I did a replica.
Right. Okay. Where did you go immediately after you finished your basic training?
We all went back to these transit camps at Sidi Blabès. And there, of course, they found out that I was destined for the music, and off I went to the music. Within hours of arriving in Sidi Blabès, I was putting my effects up in the music and in the office rather than as a musician. And there, I suppose there must have been at least 100 in the music there. And it was renowned as the finest military band in Europe.
And so you were saying that you wanted to be a tenor saxophone player.
Well, I did have lessons.
But you didn't find that, then you said that you didn't, there was no adventure in it.
No, it wasn't so exciting at all. But suddenly it began to get exciting because the colonel himself on one occasion phoned up Captain Acker, the captain. I used to go around on a bicycle, touting for... We used to do programs, do you see, for the music concerts that they had in town. And so somebody in the office had to do it, and I used to do it on a... Oh, golly. It was sort of a gel in a tin tray. And you did the gel, and then I typed out on the machine, a very, very ancient machine, the concert. The items that were going to be played at the next concert, and I used to have to do it with a carbon, you see, a special carbon.
Yes.
And then I turned the carbon over and put it onto the cyclostyle,
yes,
the gel, and you know, had a thing to sweep over it, a roller. And then I took that off, and then the programs I had folded into a certain shape, and I just put them down onto the gel. Lifted it off, and the program was done, do you see? Very often there were mistakes and had to be corrected, and you had to do the whole blooming thing again. But the gel melted, you know, over the stove. And so that was mainly my job, was to produce the programs, deliver them into town, and tout for people to advertise on the programs in order to buy new instruments and provide for transport, you know.
It was at least self-financing.
And I used to enjoy this. I used to go out in the morning and go to the market and have my... By this time, I've started a little bit to drink. I would have, in the winter, rum and blackcurrant in the market. But in the music and during meals, for meals, we always had a glass of wine, as I mentioned before. But I would sell my glass of wine to one of my friends. We were called the Three Musketeers, although we were four. and they used to buy it for their dessert.
Ah,
I didn't used to drink my wine, but I had an extra dessert.
Bought it for dessert.
Now, there was Ulrich, an Estonian, who played the violin and the bass saxophone, and then Dardenne, wonderful trumpeter, and that's what he played in the orchestra and the military band. He was a Belgian, and I'm sure that there was, that wasn't his real name, Dardenne, but I'm sure, you know, there was something, probably a love business in his past. But of course, this is the sort of thing one never asked and never told about, really. And I was a nonentity because I didn't have a past, you know. But then there was Jock Lawrence. Now, Lawrence was a Scotsman, and he played the trombone and the second fiddle. And he used to give English lessons in City Blabes. Well, when he packed up just before the war and went away, do you see, back to Scotland, I think he called on my brother, and he didn't look too good, but he never left any names or addresses, but I think my brother gave him a couple of meals or something, and, you know, and some money for his pocket. Then we've never heard of Jock since, but I took over all his English lessons in St. Blabes.
But he left the Legion, did he? Or
yes, he left the Legion at the end of his... I think he'd done 10 years.
Really?
Yeah.
What was the arrangement then? You joined on for five?
The minimum to start with was five.
And then, after
you could, after that, any length, any period.
I see. And, okay. I'm sorry, the question I was going to ask was just gone. Yes, let's go on about it wasn't enough adventure in the Legion.
Oh, yes, you asked about. Well, this was getting exciting, do you see, going out and giving English lessons when I wasn't supposed to be out of the barracks, do you see.
Right.
And so I was doing it on the...
QT.
On the QT, and I was getting paid for it, you see, and I was getting quite a lot of money, really, compared to my ordinary pay. And what's more, I was meeting up with wonderful people, and I could have had, you know, 55 affairs, really. But I used to respect these young girls, of just a little bit younger than myself, who were preparing their baccalaureate, which is in between A-level and O-level, I suppose. But it's a recommended degree that one has to go through in France to get anywhere in university. And so, you know, and I was being invited out to meals, especially at one place where both the father and the mother were head teachers. And so I used to get out quite a lot, and I had this bicycle, you see. Never locked my bicycle up, never hid it away, really. And I always used to go out. And being in the... on the distribution side, if you think, if you like, of the programs and the music, I had an authorization signed by Colonel Azon, the colonel of the regiment, permitting me to go out in town any time I wanted to, on my bicycle. As a matter of fact, when war was declared, I also used to go out with my rifle across my shoulders and five cartridges in my pocket. And this was, you know, unheard of. No, yeah. I don't think... But also, with the colonel's permission, when we had visitors of some import who spoke English, or who didn't speak English, but who wanted to visit the music, for instance, in the museums, then the colonel had told Mr. Acker, Captain Acker, the head of the music, that I was the most fit and proper person to do this, because I had such an amount of liberty being in the music and being always there rather than any of the other companies that were stationed in Blabes who had to go out on manoeuvres, although we did go out on manoeuvres. But, you know, 99% of the time the music was sort of living, shall we say, in City Blabes and the Catty of Vienna. And so I was the best person to do it. And we used to get quite a lot. Used to get the RAF and the Navy personnel coming down in taxis most of the time.
Or you say RAF, coaches. The French Air Force. French Air Force.
Yes, no, yeah. No, British Air Force.
Really?
From Oran. I mean, our battleships used to come into Oran, as was proved later on.
Yes, see, yes.
The affair of Berzal Kabir. And they used to come there, and then they used to hire buses or taxis and come down to visit the Legion, like Regent's Park Zoo. And so, you know, officers used to come as well. And first, the first time I was detailed by the Service Général, that's the...
like the admin staff.
General...
was it admin staff?
No, it was what they call general... general maintenance.
Okay.
There was a senior NCO there, a company sergeant major, who was in charge of the business there. And when they used to appear at the gate, you see, then he used to get Dutch, or the clairon, the bugler, would come out and blow for the music, you see, and the office of the music, you see, not the corporal of the day or the sergeant of the day or the officer of the day, you know, they'd blow for the office. And I, you know, if I was there, then I would go. Mm. And it would be to, you know, I would find these Navy Wallahs or the RAF people there, you know, wanting to visit the museum. And so I would take them round, and of course we'd make a beeline for the
and
nearest
pubs. And
you would
do the translation as well with the,
yes, yes, of course.
The interpreter.
Interpreter, yeah. Yes, that's right.
And what did they what did they make of you in the Legion? I mean, they must
have... Oh, it was great fun, you see. You know, and on one occasion I remember one taxi coming down.
Well, what did they say? I mean, it must have been a double take or something like that. I mean,
four of them came down, and they came down not only once, but they came down a second time. And the second occasion they came down, and after I'd shown them the pubs, because they'd already visited the museums, they didn't want to see. We went back, and they said, come on, Eddie, get inside. They had a petty officer's uniform in there, Navy petty officer's uniform, and I was supposed to change in the taxi, and the next stop would be Oran and
the
battleship.
Out of it, yes.
Yeah. But I said, no, no, that's not the way I'm going out. Signed for 5 years. There was another group of young people, three young people. How they got to know me or my name, I think they made a mistake myself. But they flew out in a private plane from northern France, having gone across the channel in the private plane, and they flew out from France and then down to southern France, and then from there across to Algeria, Sidi Blabès, and they landed at Sidi Blabès on a terrain which was called the airfield, like, but it was just, you know, desert terrain, really, and which was kept clear of stones and big boulders. They landed there, they came to the Legion, took a taxi, and got to the Legion, and I took them around, and then they wanted me to get into the taxi. Next stop would be the plane where there was no customs or anything like that, and the next stop would be, you know, we'd be on our way back to England. And they knew me by name and who I was, you know, English and where I was and all that. But I never found out.
How did they?
And they were just young. I mean, they were a bit younger than me even.
And they. But what profession were they in that they got this sort of money for a private plane? Or
oh, they. Oh, yes. I've got a feeling, you know, it's such a long time ago. I've got a feeling that they were society people, and you know, they might have been involved in a newspaper a bit or something like this.
Yes.
You see.
Yes.
But they were extremely good, I know.
They must have had an angle. I mean, one has the feeling there must have been an angle on it.
But, you know, I didn't take that up either because I was enjoying myself giving English lessons, and the risk was there all the time that I'd be found out or that I'd get involved. One of the girls, you know, thought she was involved, as a matter of fact, when I was leaving. And then came July the 14th in 1939, just before the outbreak of war.
Right.
And for the first time ever, the kepi blanc, the white kepis with the cover on, for the first time ever, went out of North Africa to Paris to play, to march down the Champs-Élysées and lead the parade down the Champs-Élysées on the 14th of July, which is the national day in France. And we were only there 4 days.
You went to Paris?
Yes.
Really? By plane?
Train.
By train.
Oh, by train. I mean, planes. They were not heard of in those days, not transport planes. And so we were there for 4 days, and I danced with on the last night, in front of the Bastille, on the Place de la Bastille, I danced with Marlene Dietrich.
Really?
Who loved the French Foreign Legion, you see. Unluckily, pity, it was the last night. but because, I mean, she was really involved in the Legion. She did a one with, might it be called Beaugest or Beau Sabreau or something like this, with Cary Grant or Gary Cooper. Mm. Gary Cooper. Mm. Yes, something like that. And so we came back, and then, of course, immediately afterwards, war broke out.
Yes. What, did you go back in the same conditions you went out? You came
to
out?
To Paris?
Yes.
Oh, yes, yes, by train.
But in the boat?
Oh, across, yes.
In the hold of the boat?
Always in the hold, but might have been the third platform this time, because we were the music, and we did concerts on board.
All right, okay.
No, in fact, we were playing more or less the whole of the time on board, and back to Oran, and then by train back to Célib-la-Bès.
Where did you stay? Where did you stay in Paris? In a barracks, presumably.
Oh, in the barracks, yeah,
right.
Not far from the Bastille.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Well, it must have been a good time then to go to
infantry barracks. They were.
Right. To go to Paris.
No, we didn't have time.
No.
Not at all. I mean, we didn't know Paris then. Mm-hmm. And there were quite a number of concerts to be given.
Oh, so it's full program.
You know, for in the officers' mess, for instance. Mm-hmm. The officers' school, l'école militaire.
Yes, yes.
Things like that. But we got back, and then war broke out. And as soon as war broke out, I got in touch with the American attaché in Algiers. He was in charge of British affairs.
I see.
See? And so I wrote to him, and then he wrote back to me saying that he had no instructions concerning British citizens in the French Foreign Legion, and he couldn't do anything about it. Then there was they put a notice on the board asking because, of course, when war broke out, when war was declared, that meant the dissolution of the music, of the regimental music.
All right, so war footing.
Only trumpeters, a group of trumpeters and drums. You know, kettle drums were side drums rather were kept. You know, for when a general arrived, you know, and that sort of thing. But the orchestral music was dissolved, and the musicians were scattered into the various companies in Célib-la-Bès. And I, here again, I didn't ask, you know, for a plonk, if you like. But I was made librarian. You see. And the library in the foyer in the Nafid, you see, was in a bit of a state, and I worked hard at this. You know, I really worked hard and got it. And then there was a notice up saying, volunteers for Narvik, you see.
Yeah.
So I immediately put my name. I was probably one of the first to put my name down for Narvik. And then I was called into the colonel's office, and the adjutant told me, no way. Was any Englishman going to be allowed to go to Narvik? They were going via Liverpool. And of course, then the British Army or the British, yes, government would have prior call upon my services, do you see, if word got out, which it would have done, no doubt about it. Because I was in as English and, you know, under my real name, not that I hadn't committed any offences at all, but the Legion authorities. I was wondering if they... No, they said what they said was that the British government, would have a prior claim on my services once we landed it onto British soil.
Sure.
And so I couldn't go. And the next thing I know, you see, there was I in the library, and still giving my English lessons, but acting as a part-time batman to the company sergeant major. Who was in charge of the NAFI and the library.
So you were giving English lessons?
I was giving English lessons.
Were you making much money out of that?
Yes. It
all was over the place.
Very paying. Yes. But I was also spending a lot on friends, you know, and taking them out and drinking and...
Developing bad habits.
Developing bad habits, yes.
Oh, really? Okay.
I started drinking wine then.
All right. And
but I was a great asset to the library.
Yes.
But I, you know, this is not what I wanted.
No.
Not at all what I wanted. And I'd almost given up in despair when suddenly the war had been going for 12 months or so. Another notice sheet out in the foyer in the Nafi, volunteers for Indochina. Now then, by that time we had a whole lot of Jewish people that had come into the Legion.
From which countries?
From all the Eastern European countries, and from France, and from Germany. And there were quite a number of Germans, of course, there at the time, who had left Germany in 1933 when Hitler started, yes. to, you know, started so, to become powerful.
But you'd also put the standard Germans as well, if I can put it that way.
Yes, but yeah. they don't come into this, really. They might have put their names up on the board. And so there were a lot of, and I was lucky in that 90% of the Jewish recruits, for instance, had been professors at in Germany, in Heidelberg, readers at in Paris, you know, at the what's it called?
I know the one you mean. It's the Observatoire, is it?
Yeah. Well, in any case, the great University of Paris.
Sorbonne.
La Sorbonne.
Yes.
Yes, we had a reader at the Sorbonne. And I know for a fact we had a professor from Heidelberg and, of course, from Germany. All these others who had been bankers and merchants and all the rest of it and who were of a very, very important class in society. And there they were, you know, second-class soldiers. Mm-hmm. And here am I, a first-class soldier. And so we used to get together and used to come to the library, you see, and there were we made bridge parties and chess, you know, and it was lovely, really, and listening to them talking and getting them to talk, and me being a little bit of a particular person, do you see, or a special person, and so life was pretty very interesting, but then this list went up, do you see, and I think that every Jewish refugee put his name up on the list, and this was. I'm sure the whole reason for the list being put up in the first place because Vichy government had taken over, you see, in France, and the Germans had established a German control in at Algiers itself, in the city of Algiers, and it was a known fact that Germans from the commission were going round the Legion barracks finding out from the Troisième Bureau records the names and where they came from, you see, of everybody that was in the French Foreign Legion there in that particular barracks, you see, and they were going around all the barracks. And so Azon, no, he'd been replaced by Robert then, was dead against Vichy, you see. And so he didn't agree with this. Yeah, and so that's why before the commission could, or as soon as he heard that the commission was sending out...
this is the general.
Colonel Robert, who was in charge of the whole of the Foreign Legion, the 1st Regiment there, and he was against Vichy, and so as soon as he heard about this commission that was being set up, he organised a detachment to go to Indochina.
To get the blokes out of it.
Yes, but supposedly, purportedly, to relieve those of the 5th Regiment who were medically sick or who had come to the end of their engagement, you see, to replace them. However, how they were going to get back, you know, was quite another question. But organized by Robert, he organized this specifically for the Jews and me, for instance, an Englishman, and those Germans who had been against Nazi Germany to get out of North Africa and away from the Nazi book,
and everybody did everybody realize this or
well it stood out didn't
okay,
it
okay I don't know
it stood
I,
out really
you know about it I don't
everybody seemed to know that the German that there had been a German investigating I can't remember investigating one of the officers anyhow and asking
so,
for lists
right so what had happened was that I mean these blokes had gone off to Narvik.
Oh, that was the first victory of the Allied forces.
Yes.
With the Legion at Narvik.
Yes.
Although it was a disaster afterwards, like that.
And they became the Free French.
That's right. Most of them joined up with de Gaulle when they came back, but a lot of them were lost, of course, at Narvik.
Yes.
But most of them came back and joined the Free French. Others, I don't know, they were repatriated, I suppose, to France.
But what happened after the fall of France then at Sidi Bel Abbès? So what sort of year are we up to now?
Well, the fall of France, of course, was 1940. Mm-hmm. June 1940, when Paris fell. Mm-hmm. And the whole of France and German, and the Germans, of course, occupied 75% of France. Mm-hmm. And then shortly afterwards, then occupied the whole part, the whole of France. But so in 1940, as I said, the Germans are starting to investigate the people that are in the Foreign Legion.
So what, can you just go over what happened in France, in Sidi Bel Abbès, when it... I think we better finish.
Nothing.